today. The first one, I'm going to finish off the 18th century, finish off Locke, Shaftesbury, Hobbes, by talking about a specific topic, humour. And then I move forwards 100 years to the 19th century, the 1800s, to talk about the first of two lectures about the great Charles Darwin. Okay. This lecture. Hobbes, Locke and Shaftesbury and their ideas about humour. Not because, except for the case of Shaftesbury, not because Hobbes and Locke were particularly interested in humour, they weren't. But I sometimes think that the general philosophies which I'm talking about, their general views about human nature, can be a bit abstract. And sometimes it helps to explain their positions by considering a specific topic and a topic which you can all understand and which you all know about. You all know about jokes and humour. You all laugh and you all probably have some sort of idea of why you laugh. And so I'll be looking at Hobbes and Locke particularly, why they laugh, their theories of why we laugh. So it's a way of understanding how different historical approaches deal with a specific topic and one which should be familiar to us. And again, there are similarities with modern theories. Modern theories of humour, the superiority theory, which I'll talk about, the incongruity theory, and also Shaftesbury, again, something which I talked about last week, a link-up with certain approaches which go under the heading today of discourse analysis. That's what I shall be talking about today. Hopefully, unlike last week, I have brought the right overheads in. Again, I felt so bad afterwards how that error occurred. Oh. And if anyone is still perplexed by last week's lecture because I brought in the wrong notes, please email any perplexities you might have about Reed. One or two of you already have done that, and I hope I've tried to explain things. Okay, let's start with the great Thomas Hobbes, the great and rather troubling Thomas Hobbes. Now, as I've tried to say, but Hobbes's view about humans is based on a psychology of personal motive. He says that underneath all what we seem to be doing, all the great things we do, there's selfishness. We're driven by trying to maximise our own pleasure and avoid our own pains. Locke, as I say, in his theory of humour, very different. Hobbes's theory of humour will be based on his rather cynical view about human motives. Locke, very cognitive approach. How do we process information? And what is the information? What is it in the outside world which makes us laugh? Hobbes will be looking inside. What is it about our emotions which makes us laugh? Locke, what is it about the outside world which we find funny? And Shaftesbury, who I think has the better view of humour than either two, is very different. He, of course, generally was rejecting both Locke's and Hobbes's view of human nature. And similar to modern discourse analysis, he's not trying to look for causes, saying, oh, what makes us laugh? What is the stimulus which makes us laugh? Or what is the emotion which makes us laugh? and say, well, you can't understand humour. You can't understand humans if you take that view. You can't understand humans if you all the time are looking for individual motives or individual perceptions. Put the phenomenon in terms of the wider system. Like discourse analysts who say, look at the whole nature of language and look and see the details of language. Look and see how discourse or language shapes how we think, how we react. And to study language, to study thinking, indeed, we should study language, not just language as an abstract system, but how we use language in social life. What is the function of language? Not what is the cause of this reaction, but what is the function of the whole system? And Charles Spring was not looking for causes. We often assume that psychology, oh, it's about looking for causes. But there are certain forms of study behaviour, what we do, human thinking, where we're not actually looking for causes. We're just seeing, observing what we do and the complexity of what we do and trying to see the function what we do, how what we do fits in with other things and enables social life to continue, which is very different from looking at causes. The desire to find functions is not the same as looking at causes. Now, you may not have got this distinction yet, but I'll try and explain it later. And if you still don't get it, then please raise your hands and say, I don't get it. Explain it again. Don't just sit there and say, oh, I don't get it. Oh, I don't get it. Oh, this is all beyond me. It shouldn't be. If it is, blame me. But if it is, and you don't put up your hands, then blame yourself. Right. Hobbes and humour. Look for the underlying motive. This is what Hobbes is saying. What is the motive behind people's laughter? Can we explain humour in terms of the motive? Oh, I've forgotten the attendance sheet. Sorry. Now, there's a short passage about the topic in Hobbes' book, Human Nature. Short discussion in his chapter called The Passions of the Mind. Passions. He's talking about emotions. Well, you could say, well, why didn't he talk about emotions? Why does he talk about passions? Do not assume that the words which are familiar to us and which we use today have always existed, indeed always existed in the English language. Emotion seems such a common word. It seems so useful to us that it's hard to imagine that English didn't always contain the word emotion. Do any of you know when emotion came into the English language, the word emotion? You probably never even thought about it. It really was only in the 1800s. Before then, people like Hobbes would write about passions. And when he writes about passion, he certainly doesn't mean what the word passion has come to mean in modern English, now that we have the word emotion. Passion often means sexual love or something like that. Well, no, passion in those days just meant emotion. What moves you? In fact, it was more likely to refer to religious passion. Okay, and he asks a question here in Human Nature. in a short section, what is the passion, i.e. what is the emotion, which causes laughter? You've got the outward response, ha, 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 ha. What is the person feeling which leads to this reaction, response of ha, 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 ha? And he starts off with a very important point, that it would be easy to say that what causes laughter is humour or wit, or to use the old term, jest. And when you put the cause outside of a person or outside of the body, saying that wit or jest or funniness causes us to laugh. But he says, Hobbes, great cynic that he was, says that actually we often laugh at things, and most often laugh at things, which no one could call witty. For men laugh at mischances or indecencies, wherein there lies no wit or no jest at all. So at the outset he's saying, if you want to find the cause of laughter, don't then study good jokes and see what property good jokes have, because often we laugh at things which are not witty in any objective sense or funny. For example, imagine as I'm going on and on and on about Hobbes's theory and Locke's theory and whatever, those in the front row start noticing something about me. They notice that I have not checked my zipper on my trousers. And they notice I am undone as I talk about Locke's theory of mind independence. And I go to point there, and suddenly my trousers spring open. And you're all laughing. You're laughing. You're smiling. And as Hobbes would say, there's no wit there. That's not a clever piece of humour. I've left my trousers undone. No, you're laughing at mischances and indecencies. We also laugh at infirmities and absurdities of others. Yes, the dignified lecturer. Imagine I was very elegantly dressed. Imagine I was a rather snooty academic who loved talking about long words, and seem to imply that actually all of you are a bit stupid, you don't understand this theory and whatever. And then you notice my flies were undone, and the more elegant for tall, imagine I was 6 foot tall and elegant and whatever, and my flies were undone, it would be even funnier. And as I was talking about the theory of wit and humour, and you all started laughing, and then I was imagining you were laughing at my very academic jokes, and you laugh, that would make you laugh even more. And then after a while I would get perplexed and think, why are you laughing? And you would laugh even more. And then I look down and notice the gaping gap in my trousers. What do I do? Join in the laughter and say, hoo, 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 I left my trousers under. No. Bright red. Oh, God. What happens? Oh, no. Oh, no. And you would laugh even more. And I would rush out the room. And would I sleep that night? Oh, God. I'm tossing and turning, thinking, oh, why didn't I check? Oh, they must think I'm such a fool. And they were all laughing at me. And as Hobbes said, we don't like to be laughed at. We don't join in that laughter. So it's not something objectively funny. Because if a joke's on us, we might pretend to laugh. Oh, but we will weep in private. How could those ignorant students concentrate on my trousers when I was talking about the great Thomas Hobbes? So Hobbes concludes, humour is nothing else, the passion of laughter is nothing else but a sudden glory arising from a sudden conception of eminency in ourselves by comparison with the infirmities of others. That you are sat there and you realise how absurd I am, going on and on and on without even looking down to see I'm properly zipped. Or maybe I'm being rather arrogant in my talking of this theory and whatever, and I don't look at what's on the ground and I slip over on this thing and, oh, it's funny as well. And what it is, according to Hobbes, is you're not just seeing me come down a few steps, as if I'm not so grand as I thought I was, but you, by comparison, become superior. You're all there, properly zipped and buttoned up, properly dressed. You're not tripping over things. And it's funny to see someone else, especially someone who likes to glorify themselves as being very dignified and superior, as coming down and being, for that sudden, unforeseen moment, rather inferior. And this is known as the superiority theory of laughter. And don't forget, Hobbes lived in a less politically correct time than we did. People would laugh at dwarves. People would laugh at those who had infirmities. People would laugh if someone else fell over. But we still do find that funny under some times. And he always thought, but it wasn't just the misfortune happening to the other, which we laugh at, is the comparison, the implicit comparison between ourselves and the other person. But suddenly, any doubts which we might have about our position in life, self-doubts about ourselves, are just at that moment forgotten, because we can feel ourselves superior to the person who is making an idiot. And what's Hobbes doing? He's revealing a hidden, unpleasant motive behind laughter. And of course, this fits his general theory, which is to look for hidden motives, and particularly not very pleasant motives, which do not reflect well upon us as a species. And he claims that this causes all laughter. The passion of laughter is nothing else. He doesn't say, oh, it sometimes happens, or it occasionally happens. He says it's nothing else but, meaning it's always this at its root. Right, do you all get this theory of humour, the superiority theory of humour? And of course, if we're all honest, we will all admit, yes, sometimes it's right. Sometimes we do laugh at others, particularly those who think of themselves as high and mighty to us, and then coming down a peg or two, and goodness, it's funny. Imagine the Prime Minister at question time, not realising he was zipped up. Ho, 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 wouldn't we all? And in the 18th century, so many theorists who address the topic of humour. And actually, the 18th century, particularly in Britain, was a time of great interest in why we laugh. I think it was because it was a time when good conversation was coming to the fore amongst the middle classes. And people wanted to say, well, Hobbes is wrong. There's nothing horrible about all sorts of laughter. There's good, witty laughter. And that doesn't fit in to his theory. So theorists wanted to oppose him. And Locke was an early one. A very different approach to humour, and very much a cognitive approach. But also, cognitive looking at the thoughtful elements of our mind, and looking outside our mind to the elements in the world which might objectively be funny, or humorous, or witty. But it all fits into Locke's general approach, which is really how the mind works, how we process information, how we deal with judging things which we presume to be outside of us. Okay. And in his essay, in book 2, chapter 9, verse 2, he has a short passage where he discusses the difference between wit, what is witty, and judgment. Judgment particularly is where we reflect on things we see and judge them and make judgments, and indeed the sorts of judgments which lead to knowledge. And here, because he's making a contrast between the two, he is assuming that wit, humour, doesn't lead to knowledge. It leads to delight and amusement. And judgment is something different, which is much more serious and leads to knowledge. Well, what is judgment? Well, basically, judgment is a process by which we consider two ideas, and remember, Locke has a very general concept of ideas, which appear to be similar, but we judge them, we look at them, we analyse them, and think they're different. And this relates to Locke's general philosophy of knowledge. But scientists, above all, try to find differences in the world which lay people think as being similar. This is what science is. Don't forget, he lived in the age of the microscope, showing things which ordinary people didn't know. Blood, just think it's red, and it's all the same. With a microscope, you can see, there's differences within the blood. There are corpuscles. And Locke, like many 17th century figures, followed the corpuscular theory of blood, which Harvey had followed. And it would come later that actually, if you look carefully, the blood has two different sorts of corpuscles, the red corpuscles and the white corpuscles. And this, for people like Locke, this is how science advances, by discovering differences. Oh, think just whale is a fish. Look carefully at the whale, you'll realise it's not a fish. Oh, think this bird is just like this bird, a rook is just like a crow. No, look carefully, they're different. This would follow from Locke's theory that knowledge is based on perception. But it's not just based on perception, it's based on perception and then judging your perceptions. And that knowledge is based on finding small differences. Okay. Nothing funny in this. Oh, there's red blood corpuscles and white blood corpuscles, and no one is going to fall on the floor and say, ho, 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 isn't that funny? No, this is serious business, according to Locke. But humour comes from the opposite process, according to Locke, where you take two things which are different and known to be different, but for the sake of entertainment, you consider them the same. You don't seriously consider them the same, you just compare them as if they were the same. But humour creating unreal but agreeable similarities. And Locke says, humour works a bit like metaphor. You know, a metaphor where you say something is like something else. Love is like a summer's day. That's from Shakespeare. That's the sort of thing which Locke said it adds to the gaiety of life. When you say, not love, you're trying to analyse it, you say, love is like a summer's day, or my love is like a river, it endlessly flows and gets deeper and deeper. When you compare one thing to another, shall I compare thee to a summer's day? And this is the sort of wit which Locke has in mind. One which isn't going to make you hoot with laughter, but just smile. Oh, isn't it nice? But it's not true. When you say, my love is like a river, I'm not actually meaning my love is a river, I shall go for a swim in my love and go fishing it. No, you don't mean it like that. You mean it's like it. You're comparing two things which are different, but the comparison allows you to say something else. Let me give a more modern example. And a dreadful one, crude one, the sort of one which wouldn't find its way into Locke's book. Have any of you watched, it's now just finished, In the Thick of It, a political satire program? No? You have? Written by, it's about politicians and it mocks the public relations of politicians. I'm shocked at you. I bet if I said, have you watched Come Dancing? Bloody hands would go in the air. But have you watched this brilliant political satire? No, where's I can't. No. There was an article about it recently. And about the writer of it, the main deviser of it, talked about how he had a team of writers, and one of the writers, his job was the swear word expert, because In the Thick of It has a lot of bad language, as these public relations people or political advisors swear and try and bully each other. There's particularly one notable bully, and his language is dreadful. And at one stage, in one of the early scripts, the swear word advisor got the script where the bully says to another politician, pardon me, I'm just quoting, you're fucking useless. And the swear word advisor wrote in, but this is not funny in itself. It needs to be made humorous. And he proposed the line, which was used in the series, you're as fucking useless as a marzipan dildo. Now, I'm not going to explain the joke to you, but it fits in with Locke of making a comparison for the sake of entertainment, which is not to be taken seriously. It's on the lines of someone is as useless as a chocolate teapot. It indicates an exemplifies the uselessness of the object, but it's creating unreal but agreeable similarities, but which are not to be taken for real. It's not like knowledge where you're looking for differences. And produces agreeableness and gaiety of a fancy. Lovely expression, gaiety of a fancy. And that, of course, is Locke was writing centuries before the word gay had its modern sense. Okay, have you got Locke? You may not think it's a useful theory. You may say it's as bleeding useless as Abel. Believe or metaphor. I'm not repeating that one. I shall get into trouble if I do. Now, we got two separate theories. Locke, different from Hobbes. Locke, no unpleasant about it. In fact, he's talking about gaiety and fancy. He's actually elevating humour to a bit of wit. And what he's doing is concentrating on the conceptual properties of wit, the judgments which the mind makes, not on the motive to laugh. He's actually looking outside the individual mind, saying, if a text has these properties which are making similarities where none exist, but doing it for the sake of entertainment, then we will probably smile. And there are similarities between Locke's theory and Hobbes's, but Hobbes is saying humour is unpleasant. It's not very nice. We're just laughing at people falling over or people who are not as good as ourselves. And Locke is actually saying humour isn't very important. It's just a bit of passing entertainment. But treating things which are different as if they're similar is not as important as looking for real differences in the world. But there is a similarity between both Locke and Hobbes. They're searching for the cause. What causes us to laugh, or in Locke's case, I don't think it's a laugh, it's more of a smile. What is the cause? In this sense, both are an atomistic theory of humour. They're taking something very complicated, like writing a joke, or telling a joke, and breaking it down into a simple cause, something simple. But it's, according to Hobbes, it's just an internal emotion. And Locke, it's a particular arrangement of similarities and differences. And typically, in doing this, and there are modern psychological theories which take this same tack and say, what is the motive, or what are the properties of the stimulus? It's not providing a social account. And it misses out something very important, which many later theorists talk about, that we tend to laugh more together than we do on our own. And if this is so, that we laugh more and humour is better shared together than solitary, then we can ask the question, not what is the cause of our laughter, but what is its function? What does the system of laughter contribute to wider social systems or wider social roles? Do you see the difference between the function and the cause, the individual cause, what made this occur in this time, and what does the habit of laughter, the pattern of laughter, contribute? How does it operate in relation to other systems or functions in the social world? Does anyone want me to go over that again? I promise I won't laugh at them. I promise I won't say, oh, I'm superior to you. I understand it, you don't, I won't. But it is important to grasp this difference between cause and function. No, no. You're brilliant. Unlaughable in your brilliance. And this is where Shaftesbury comes in. A very different view, not looking for causes. And he has this in his chapter on common sense in his book Characteristics, where he talks about freedom and wit and makes a very, very important political point, one which I think is as true today as it was when he wrote 300 years ago, that there is a link between wit, laughter, humour, and political freedom. And certainly his approach is not individual, it's social. He's not reducing humour to a cognitive process or an emotional process or trying to find the cause. He's looking at the social importance, the function. What happens if we don't have laughter? And this fits his general holistic view. Look at things in terms of the wider systems in which they're part, and the systems within systems. So we could say, what is the system of humour? What does it contribute to human life, or does it take away something from human life? And in this sense, it's more similar to modern sorts of discursive psychology, which are not looking for causes, not looking for hidden motives, not looking for the properties of texts in order to see what effect they have on the readers. They look at the system of talk. And what he's doing is looking at humour in conversation and asking, what is the function of humour in conversation? What function? If you took out humour, what couldn't you do in conversation? Now, what I think is very, very topical and modern, that where he discusses humour, Shaftesbury, he's actually also talking about political freedom. And don't forget, when he was writing, there wasn't political freedom of speech guaranteed in Britain. But there still was censorship. And he argues that the religious extremists, he uses the word zealots. Religious zealots try to ban freedom of speech. They say certain things are so blasphemous that they shouldn't be said. And he's writing against the zealots who try to curtail freedom of speech. And this, I think, is not it is an old text, but I think it has a modern relevance. And then he says, do you know, there's one thing above all which the religious zealots, the extremists, hate. It's mockery. It's laughter. They try to impose seriousness on the world. They don't like laughter. Does the Taliban strike you as a fun organisation? He says, Shaftesbury, but mockery, laughter, is not just a sign of human freedom of expression, but it is vital for human life, vital for human thought. And his view of mockery or humour is very different from Hobbes, where Hobbes is just a personal pleasure at the expense of others. For Shaftesbury, it's to do with the conditions of freedom. It's not just that we need freedom to laugh because we enjoy laughter, but laughter plays a very important role, has a very important function in terms of freedom and freedom thought. And he talks about raillery. Raillery is mockery. It's an old-fashioned term. And he's not saying crude raillery. But what he calls defensive or true raillery. Not gross or clown. He was very much a snob. But witty and occurring in good conversation. Mockery. Not just yarboo mockery. But interesting mockery. Why should it be linked to freedom and to the battle against religious zealotry? Well, Shaftesbury said, mockery and humour is a condition for good conversation, a freedom of raillery or mockery, a liberty in decent language to question everything, an allowance of unravelling or refuting any argument without offence to the arguer. That we should have conversations where we mock each other without trying to cause offence. We mock by trying to assess what the other person has said. And what he's doing is linking political freedom with mockery. You can't do this. You can't really analyse or question authorities unless you mock them, unless you try to mock what they say. And he says this is why the zealots try and curtail freedom of expression and will kill people for mockery. And remember, Shaftesbury is writing half a century after the English Civil War, but also he knew on Europe that people would be burnt for mocking religious authorities. And it is quite likely he wasn't a Christian himself. But why is it so important? And this is where his argument develops, because he says mockery or raillery is a way of questioning opinions. You mock them. It's a way of evaluating opinions. You find their weakness through mockery. Not any old mockery, say yahoo, whatever, but trying to joke about them. And if an opinion cannot stand a bit of mockery, then it will be shown to be a weak opinion, not worth holding. And Shaftesbury's model was always the dialogues of Plato, where Plato wrote these little playlets. He was a great philosopher, Plato, but he wrote plays rather than series track 1 point, 2 point. And in his little plays, there was Socrates wandering round the marketplace of Athens, meeting others, asking them their views, and then gently mocking their views, showing the contradictions of their views, getting them to question their views through mockery. And all this implies the importance of mockery. But this is not related to personal emotion, and certainly he didn't have in mind the sort of mockery which Hobbes was writing about, the clownish mockery of just laughing at someone with their flies out. Socrates didn't do that. But it becomes a means of testing opinions, particularly received opinions, and a social way of testing opinions. And this is why serious authorities don't like it. They don't want their opinions questioned, and they certainly don't want their opinions questioned through mockery. And there's a wider implication. Remember, Locke's general aim was to find out the basis of knowledge. And for Locke, knowledge was based on perception and how we process information. And it's very much an individual process. You've got to attend to your own mind and think, this view which I have, is it based on my perceptions? And Hobbes, it was, you've got to free judgments from emotions. Emotions get in the way. We've got to try and free ourselves from these emotions and match judgments to perception. But Shaftesbury has a very, very different view of knowledge. Knowledge isn't certainty or science. Knowledge is insight. And insight will come through dialogue, through conversation. But knowledge, therefore, is not an individual process. It's a social process. We talk together. We argue together. We test our opinions together. And here, like the discursive psychology, he's not looking for the cause of what makes us laugh. Is it inside ourselves or something out there? He's looking at how we talk, how we use language socially, and above all, how we use humour socially. That we use humour to test opinions. But there is a difference. I don't want Shaftesbury thought of like just a modern person you're going to learn about in your practicals of how to analyse conversation, because Shaftesbury, above all, is making a moral and political point, not a methodological one. Not saying, now let's examine the pauses and micro-pauses of conversation. But there is a general implication for a theory of mind, how the mind works. In Shaftesbury's view, we get to knowledge, we create knowledge, we justify knowledge, we criticise knowledge through conversation, through using language in conversation. It's not by an individual process of perception. It's through talk. And it's not through trying to get certainty. What are the basic perceptions on which we can build everything else up? But how do we improve our views? How can we talk together seriously and humorously? Through serious humour, through dialogue, and above all, if we want to think on our own. Remember what I said about that lecture on Shaftesbury? We set up dialogues, conversations within ourselves. His advice to the author was divide yourselves, debate with yourselves. I think this is as good an advice as any to give to students who have to write their essays. How do you write a better essay? Well, I could say, oh, you must have a good sparkling reference list, if that is important. But I would say much more important. Don't just put down what you've read. Put it into your own mind, and then try and argue with it in your own mind, giving the strength to both the justifications and the criticisms. Make it your argument. And through your own internal argument, even voicing out loud, you will test the strength of the arguments which you then have to write about. And what this all means is knowledge is based on dialogue, on talk, on conversation, including mockery. Mock ideas, mock them seriously, to find their weak points. And here we have in Shaftesbury a genuinely social view of the mind. We exist with other people. We live with other people. And we learn how to think by listening to how other people talk, by joining debates, and then internalizing the debates within ourselves so that we can debate with ourselves. And above all, humour, mockery, is much more than just a little bit of gaiety. It's much more than just a nasty emotion. It's a guarantor of thought, and it's a guarantor of freedom of thinking. And that is why we have to resist at all times those serious authorities who want to ban youth. They're dangerous. Not just politically dangerous, according to Shaftesbury, they're dangerous because they want to curtail human thinking. Okay. Questions, please. Anything which I can go over which you might not have understood first time round? Okay, so it was much clearer and more useful than a marzipan. Don't tea, and we'll start at 11 o'clock. Today is the first of two lectures on Darwin, 1809 to 1882. And the theory of evolution. Shush, I'm starting. And the theory of evolution. And Darwin is, in my view, one of the great writers of which you all will have heard. And I think every student of psychology should at some time or other read a bit of Darwin for themselves. Not just get it from the newspapers, but to read a bit of Darwin. Because when you read Darwin, you're reading someone intellectually of the first rank, of the Premier League. And in this lecture, I'll be saying why previous theories were a bit limited and why the 18th century way of looking at the human mind really was coming up against the buffers. I'll be talking about Darwin's life and giving an outline of his general theory of evolution and his basic assumptions. And everyone thinks they know what his theory of evolution was, but not always in detail. Now, all the theories which I've been talking about so far, whether it's Shaftesbury, whether it's Reid, whether it's Hobbes or Locke, or any of the 18th century writers, made assumptions about human nature, how humans are. And above all, they assumed that humans have a fixed nature. Want to know how humans are? We will assume that humans carry around a human nature as they always have done. Because there's an assumption that humans, and we, I wouldn't know how, were made in a particular way. Hobbes, humans made to be selfish, to pursue their own interests, and therefore they need an authority to curtail themselves. Locke, we're born with these minds which receive information and then reflect on it. We're born to be reasoning, but alert to the outside world. Reid, we're born to see the world in a particular way, to assume that the world exists. We perceive the world and we assume it to be outside of ourselves. The Shaftesbury assumption, that's the way we are. We're born helpless infants and adults look after us. Now, there's no explanation in these theories of why we should be like this or how we've come to be like this. With someone like Reed, who actually was personally religious, he would say, well, God created us like this. This is just the way our minds work. We've been created in this way. And there's an assumption, regardless of which theory, and whether the theorists were religious or not, like Hobbes wasn't and Shaftesbury wasn't, that humans are made in a particular way, just as cows are made in a particular way, or sheep, and that human nature is unchanging. We are humans. Our children will be humans, our grandchildren, grand-grand-grand-grand-grand, and so on, all humans. The ancient Greeks, who Shaftesbury revered, they were humans just like us. Nothing changing. And there also were limitations. Why are we constituted as we are? Often that question couldn't be answered. And as a growing knowledge of physiology was coming to the fore, so it couldn't be answered how our bodies, or why our bodies, work as they do, and particularly about the emotions. Let me give an example. If we ask questions about the emotions, well, certainly Hobbes, much more than Locke, wrote about emotions, the avoidance and the approach, pleasure and pain. And really throughout the 18th century, there wasn't much progress in thinkers about this. Some things we like, some things we don't like. We like pleasure, we don't like pain. And there wasn't really much insight about the relations between our bodies and our emotions. There was a growing awareness that there wasn't a relation. Once Harvey had discovered the circulation of the blood, the heart ceased to be necessarily the seat of all the emotions. It was a pump for pumping blood round. But nevertheless, there was a feeling that when we have emotions, our bodies do something. And there is a relation between the emotion and the body. But you can't say, the 18th century theorists couldn't say why that should be. Just happens. Just happens. When we get nervous, our hearts beat. Why? Oh, that's how we are. When we laugh, our mouths move up into smiles. Why? That's just how we are. Let me give an example from one late 18th century writer who actually was more famous for his politics than for his physiology and philosophical writings. I'm just giving this as an example of what in the late 18th century, before Darwin in the 19th century, people just didn't know and couldn't know. And this is Jean-Paul Marat, a Frenchman who lived in Newcastle for a while and published his philosophical essay on man in 1773 while working as a doctor in Newcastle. France at that time, Louis XIV, was a very autocratic, totalitarian king. And those who like Marat, who resisted his rule, sought safety outside of France, and he came to Newcastle and worked. And being a doctor, he was interested in physiology, and in his book, he wrote about the physiology of passions, emotions. And it's not a great theory, you will say it's not even a theory, but I'm using it to illustrate not what was known, but what wasn't known. In the same passion, the same muscles are always contracted, and in the same manner in every individual. If we went along with Hobbes, there's a passion of laughter. In laughter, our faces go, ha, 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 ha. There's always a smile, the mouth turning upwards, these muscles contracted, and so on. The same person and everyone else. We can recognise everyone else in laughter. Or if we're angry, baring the teeth and clenching the fist. Something going on with our muscles. The same passion, the same muscles. And then the question, well, why does this happen? Why does the soul implant fluid into the muscles? The soul is what I say, the mind. Why into one muscle or organ rather than another? Why for smiling into these facial muscles? Why in shame does the head incline forward? Is sadness or languor on either side of the world? Why like that? And what Mara said is, in essence, he says, I'm buggered if I know. These singular relations between the particular faculties of the soul and certain organs of the body is to me an enigma, an incomprehensible mystery, which I relinquish entirely to anyone who is willing to undertake the solution to it. And you won't find anything else in Hobbes, or in Locke, or in Shaftesbury, or other 18th century writers, which will tell you what is the relationship between the body and emotions, and why the body works this way in this emotion, that way in another emotion, and how did it come about? All, and this is a particularly thoughtful young man, he says, I don't know. We don't know. It just seems to be like it. Why? I don't know. Darwin, of course, would provide an answer. And only after Darwin could you start thinking of answers in this way. Now, I'll say a little bit more before getting on to Darwin. Let me say a bit more about Mara. Because he came back to France when the old monarchy was tottering. In 1789, there was the great French Revolution, when the new modern invention of Monsieur Guillotine, the mechanism for executing people efficiently and quickly, was put into place, and the royal family were guillotined. And the French Revolution was actually inspired by a philosophy of reason, and many of the thinkers who contributed to the French Revolution, who questioned the autocratic power of the king, were influenced by Hobbes, indirectly. Locke, I'm being stupid. But although the philosophy of reason said we needed a reasonable new order, and that the old kingship was not based on reason, the time of the French Revolution was a time of great emotion, great fear, great celebration at the guillotinings and the end of the monarchy, great distrust as the revolutionaries feared that others were holding up the process of the revolution. And Marat had come back from England, come back from Newcastle, gone to France, and was one of the leading revolutionaries. He had a very important position during the revolutionary period. He was a writer, a journalist, who knew all the important figures, and in his paper, he was constantly denouncing enemies of the revolution and setting in process the mechanism by which they then would be killed as enemies of a revolution. He was both feared and hated. Do you want to hear a little story about Marat and the young woman Charlotte Corday? Do you want me to get on to serious Darwin? No, this is a serious story. Marat suffered from a skin complaint, a very bad skin complaint, psoriasis. We don't know. He itched and he itched. His enemy said it was his conscience talking. And he had to spend at times when it was bad most of his day in bed, in the bath. So he only got relief in the bath. And at one time, there was a knock on his door, and his servant answered the door, and there was this young woman standing there who said, "I've got to speak to Monsieur Marat." It was Charlotte Corday from the west of France, the Vendée. And she said, "I have a list of all those in the west who are betraying the revolution, whom Monsieur Marat must know about." She didn't have a list. She was an enemy. In her paper, behind her paper list, was a dagger, and she was shown into his bath. And she said, "Here is my list." And as he took it from her, out came the dagger, and she murdered him. Because she held him responsible for the massacres of her family and friends in the Vendée. There was an outpouring of grief in Paris. Marat's funeral was huge. There's a great painting by a French artist which cemented Marat's fame of Marat's funeral. And Charlotte Corday, well, she also became a heroine. And if you go to the west of France, if you go on holiday to the Vendée, you'll probably see Place de Charlotte Corday, or who, that's the place, or the street of Charlotte Corday, and now you'll know the man who murdered the revolutionary and the philosophical writer in his bath. Now, big time of emotions, but we must turn to the question, why do we have emotions, and do we just have to say, as Marat said in his young life, and as he would have said to the end of his life, "Why are you so angry, Charlotte?" Poof, that's the way we're created. That's the way we are. But is there more to be said? Well, we know there's more to be said. You know the end of the story. It's Darwin. And we move now to the 19th century. Darwin, born in 1809, didn't live in the 1700s. A time, particularly in Britain, in Western Europe, of factories, of railways, of growing industrialisation, the old aristocrats being threatened. Times of growing empire, colonisation. All this will have a bearing. We'll start off with the scientific challenge of science to religious or traditional religious authorities in the early 19th century. Why? Well, fossils were being discovered, which suggested that the world was much older than the Bible has said. And the fossils were saying that there were species living thousands and thousands, millions of years ago, who no longer live now. And that led to the question, what happened to them? And also, for such species we know now, no fossils of. Something must have happened. But not all animals were created so-called at the same time by a benevolent God. And new species often seemed similar to the old species. You could find fossils in the Far East and in Asia and Africa of woolly mammoths, old sorts of elephants, huge elephants with huge tusks, resembling the modern African or Indian elephant, but different. And scientists started thinking, well, what was happening? Was there a relationship between the environment and the laws of life? So that under certain environments you find certain species, under other environments you find other species, and if so, what is the relationship? And before Darwin, the time time Darwin was born, before he grew to maturity, there was a development of what was called synthetic thinking. Doesn't mean artificial thinking. It means thinking which puts things together into synthesis. The opposite of atomism. More holistic thinking. Combining geology, anatomy, biology, zoology. Thinking that the geology of the environment may be connected with the zoology of laws of life, but not knowing quite how. The opposite of atomism, breaking things down, now trying to put things together. And in the late 18th century and the early 19th century, the idea, not the theory, the idea, the concept of evolution started occurring, being developed. People started thinking, but maybe the modern elephant has evolved in some way, derived from the woolly mammoth. Don't quite know how. And two of the great proponents were Erasmus Darwin, who was actually the father of the great Charles Darwin. He was a very, by all accounts, very sociable doctor in the late 18th century, in the late 1700s, who tended to his patients, particularly taking care of his women patients. Although he was a very fat man, who had to have a special carriage because he was so heavy, his great bulk did not seem to deter the women from his special attentions and their affections. Gossip, I shouldn't be saying this. Forget it. But it's the idea of both Lamarck and Erasmus Darwin that old species might change, mutate into new ones. And there were speculations, but these aren't scientific theories. Erasmus Darwin wrote his ideas in poems. Not in scientific papers. And they had a lack of detailed theory about the mechanism. And all this tells us something about what a scientific theory is, why these aren't scientific theories and why Darwin's was. Lamarck was particularly taken with the idea that animals develop parts of their body to get food, and they pass this down to their offspring. So giraffes wanted to get leaves from high trees, and they kept reaching up and kept reaching up, and as they did, they stretched their necks, and their children were born with stretched necks. Because he doesn't say why those same trees didn't lead to hippopotami with stretched necks, or why every species didn't look like a giraffe. But it's the germ of an idea there, but not yet scientific, just an idea. Okay, who was Darwin apart from being the grandson of Erasmus? Well, Darwin was to go further than Lamarck and provide a detailed account of the mechanism. He was also, when it comes to humans and the higher mammals, to talk about emotions, how we might have evolved emotions. This was going further, of course, than the previous theories of mind. And all this shows that science is more than just having a bright idea. Lamarck had a bright idea. But science means compiling evidence for ideas and providing explanations for why things might happen. You don't just have the idea, you need the evidence, detailed evidence, and give a plausible account of why this may have occurred and not this. And for Darwin, this was not atomism. It wasn't saying, oh, if you get a big microscope, you can see evolution. His theories were holistic or synthetic. Tying things together, tying the knowledge of animal behaviour, animal physiology, to geology, to climate, and so on. We've seen the greatness of his theory. And that animals and humans are part of wider systems, a wider system involving also the environment. And as such, Darwin was very much a product of his time, his 19th century. Let's have something about his life. Now, by and large, the people I've talked to about first so far, but with the exception of Reed, have either been aristocrats themselves or have been employed by aristocrats. In the 19th century, as Britain became industrialised, you saw the power of the aristocrats slightly diminish, but a new class, the middle class, the wealthy commercial middle class, becoming important. And this is where Darwin came from. He, on his mother's side, he was a Wedgwood. Who were the Wedgwoods? Have any of you heard of Wedgwood pottery coming from Staffordshire? Yes, you have. And the Wedgwoods, set up in the late 18th century and then throughout the 19th century, potteries in Staffordshire for mass-producing pots. And this was a business, not an old craft of making a pot, it was a factory. You needed science, the science to find new dyes, new ways of baking and so on. It was a mixture of science and commerce, and so Darwin came from a scientific background on his grandfather's side, a doctor. And he was sent as a young man to Edinburgh University to study medicine. I thought this would be good for him. And one of his lecturers at Edinburgh University was John Edmonston, who taught him physiology. We'll see the importance of this next week, definitely, who unusually was a freed slave. It was very, very unusual for a young man to go to university in those days and to be taught by someone of African ancestry. Very unusual. Changed his view, but he had a different view about non-white people than many others of his generation. He wasn't a good student. He didn't finish his degree. His parents took him away from Edinburgh University, sent him to Cambridge University to study theology. Even worse student. He was always interested in walking out in the country, observing nature, picking flowers, collecting beetles, collecting butterflies. Collection and observation. Not in a scientific way, which was no part of a course, just did it. When he should have been studying medicine or theology. And his father, in despair, wrote to him when he was a student. And all of you remember this, if your parents despair of your students. You care nothing but shooting, going out shooting birds, dogs and rat catching. And you will be disgraced yourself and all your family. Remember that if your parents tell you, oh, you don't work hard enough, we've saved half for your education and you'll be a disgrace to us all. Just say, that's just what Charles Darwin's father said about him. One other thing. You probably at times think us academics are a bit pedantic, especially about spelling and punctuation. Look here. The comma is vital. If there were no comma, the meaning would be you care nothing but shooting dogs. And Darwin did not shoot dogs. He loved dogs. He shot birds and he shot things to eat, but he didn't shoot dogs. Remember, the comma can make all the difference. Pardon me for being pompously nerdish, But if us academics aren't going to be pedantic, who else will be left to be pedantic? Well, an opportunity came for a job as a naturalist on the ship, the Beagle, which was going to go all around the world and was going to collect zoological and botanical specimens from all around the world and bring them back to the Royal Geographical Society. And Darwin's parents thought Darwin, well, he wasn't doing much good as a student, he'd be all right if he just settled down in his job on the Beagle. And it was the making of him. He collected different species of plant, different fossils, different beetles, different Lepidoptera and rocks, and returned 5 years later and made his name as a naturalist. He became a great hero. People wanted to listen to his lectures. Above all, his thinking was changed by the experience on a range of islands off the west coast of South America, the Galapagos Islands. They're wonderful islands, full of wildlife, teeming with wildlife, the sort which he'd never seen before, and lush growth. Teeming with wildlife because there were very few predators. But he noticed something curious, two things curious. But on these different islands, which weren't that far away from each other, there were very different animals, different species. And a different species of animal is an animal which cannot breed. You can have two species which look very similar, but they can't breed. It's like you can have a great tit and a blue tit. They're different species, you can't breed. Why so many similar but different species? And then the question, and also, if you compared these animals on the various islands, and you looked at the animals 150 miles away on the mainland, you'd see, they were also similar. Why did the different species on the Galapagos Islands resemble the species on the mainland? If it was all just a matter of God created these animals and they were all created at the same time, why are they so similar? Why not just have them different or entirely different? Well, you'll all know what Darwin's answer to this was. It was the beginnings of his theory of evolution, that the animals on the Galapagos Islands, say the finches or the turtles, had common ancestors on the mainland. The finches on the various islands resembled finches you'd find on the mainland, but were different, and a different species of finch. Similarly, the turtles, resembling the turtles on the mainland. And what must have happened at one stage is that the animals, in some way or other, had migrated from the mainland to the islands. They had the same ancestors on the mainland, and this would explain why they looked similar. But then they changed. And on the different islands, they were separate developments. The turtles on one island developed one way, the turtles on another developed another way, so that they changed from each other and from those on the mainland. The same with the finches, different colours, but recognisably similar finches. Some with longer beaks, some with shorter beaks. And so, if you assume that species change, this would explain why they looked similar, but actually were different. Would explain why they developed those differences, but would explain that there's some change going on in animals over time. And it would explain that minutely different animals will have common ancestors. And so that if you want to understand the changes, you have to go back in time and look at common ancestors. Well, this is just the start. That is not a scientific theory. That's a series of questions. Well, what makes Darwin scientific? Certainly not experiments. So many of you at the start saying, "Ah, oh, what makes science, psychology of science is experimental. Science is experimental." Well, are all scientists experimental? Darwin didn't do experiments. He didn't say, "Oh, let's run the process of evolution for another 2 million years, but without any finches or turtles." You can't do experiments. It's a detailed observation, close observation of the phenomena, which seemed to create a problem. And then the formulation of general laws to explain the facts, the phenomena, and especially the odd facts, the peculiar facts, in order to explain how and why events in the past may have occurred and what might be happening now. Great book was Origin of Species, but Darwin delayed publication. There's a lot of controversy why he delayed publication. Certainly he seems to have had rather depressive bits where he just got very down. Secondly, he never worked in a university. He didn't feel the need to publish. He was a gentleman. He was a farmer. He worked, lived in farms. And thirdly, there was his personality, that he knew his work would cause a bit of a brouhaha, but he was a gentle, kind man. He didn't want to get involved in public debate. And lastly, there was his dear wife. Darwin was genuinely fond of his wife, and his wife was very much a religious woman who didn't like what he was doing, didn't really agree with his ideas. There almost certainly was an extra problem which caused great pain to Darwin. His beloved daughter died at a young age, and we'll see why he wouldn't have wanted to talk about death in the way which his theory implied. But this great work, which he finally published in 1859 when he realised an American was coming up with a similar theory, had great details about biology and zoology. If you ever read it, just be struck by the details of the work. It's not just an idea, he's someone who's looked at different species. And he talks in detail about the mechanisms of evolution, how things might change. Much more sophisticated just than giraffes grow long necks. And above all, there are two assumptions. And it's the greatness of Darwin to realise the importance of these assumptions, and assumptions which are almost certainly absolutely correct. First of all, species are not uniform. There are variations. Now, Darwin was great friends with horse breeders and dog breeders. He talked to them at length. And as any horse breeder would tell him, as any dog breeder would tell him, if you get a litter of dogs or a litter of horses, they're not all the same. It's not only that they look different, they'll have different characteristics. And a dog breeder who wants to breed a dog which will be a hunting dog and bring back what is shot in its soft mouth will look for which dogs to breed, and these ones will be good hunting dogs. Same for a horse breeder who breeds fast horses, who have the skill of saying, this is the horse to breed, and these ones just ignore. These aren't so good. So species are not uniform. Same with birds and even insects, according to Darwin. There's always a variety. Oh, one thing remember when I'm talking about Darwin, although he's talking about theories of evolution and inheritance, genes were not discovered yet. Not until the late 1880s were genes discovered. There was no theory of genes. This is part of Darwin's greatness. He preceded a theory of genes. So you could say there's a variety. Brothers, sisters may have common parents, but they'll look different, be different. And then there's the second assumption. That by and large, animals produce more offspring than necessary. Which means not all can survive. And indeed, there's a struggle for existence between the offspring. Take birds in a nest. Two birds, the parents, will have to build a nest, and there may be six or seven birds. If they all lived, and then the birds had another round of eggs, that'd be 14. If every two birds had 14 birds and those birds had another 40, each of them 40, soon we would be, the air would be thickened with birds. There would be no space for birds. Instead, two birds reproduce in the event just two more birds, the species would keep constant. And so many of our offspring must die. It's a struggle for existence. And you could see why someone like Darwin, who had lost his beloved daughter, would not wish really to talk about the importance of the struggle for existence and the death of offspring. It would be painful. But he did. So those two assumptions are saying not all siblings are alike, whatever the species, and there's too many born at any one time, in any generation. And then, if you take those two assumptions, and those two assumptions are basically correct, it leads to the question, why do some offspring survive and not others? Is there a law or is it random? And Darwin, and this is the essence of his theory, which follows from those two assumptions. You must remember both two assumptions if you're going to remember Darwin's theory, is that it is not a process, a random process. For every species, there are too many born, and those who are born are not similar, and their characteristics will determine to a large extent, not in every extent, whether they survive or not. But some variations will be better attuned to survival than other variations. Imagine the birds in the nest, when the mother comes back with food in its beak, and all these birds are sitting up there opening their mouth for her to drop in. If one of the species doesn't, one of the offspring doesn't open their mouth very wide, just a bit like that, no room for dropping in. Less chance of surviving. If one really long neck and opens its mouth wide, in it will go. And that one not only will survive, but because it survived, will have greater chance itself of perpetuating itself, and that having children with big necks and wide open mouths. It's a principle. If an individual organism is better adapted to the environment, it will have an increased chance of survival and reproduction. You'll get that. And if An organism doesn't have those characteristics, it will have lesser chance of survival. It will not be adapted to the environment. And what is important for understanding Darwin, he didn't say, oh, this is survival of the fittest in the abstract, but there is a fitness which will make some individual survive and some not. It's a fitness for the environment in which they find themselves. And if it survives, its variation will be transmitted to its offspring. Just like a horse breeder knew that if you can breed two fast-running horses, the offspring are more likely to be fast-running than if you mate two sluggish horses. And this was the process of natural selection. Horse breeders unnaturally selected. But what Darwin was saying is nature selects those who are better, the variations which are better adapted to that environment to survive and therefore reproduce. A bird which cannot attract the attention of its mother to be fed is unlikely to survive, and if it's unlikely to survive, it's unlikely to transmit to its offspring that trait of being unable to attract the mother. And then there's an assumption. Things don't stay the same. Because if the environment changes, becomes hotter, colder, wetter, drier, then it's quite possible the variations which were well adapted to the previous environment may not be well adapted to the changing environment. And a different set of species or their variants will survive. So there's nothing abstract in this, there's nothing constant, there's nothing saying something is fitter in the objective sense, it's always fitness for an environment. There's always a relationship between the species and the environment, and you cannot understand, according to Darwin, the processes of evolution unless you understand the environment in which the species is living. And also there's a relationship between different species. If one species eats another, and that other species turns out not to be fitted to its environment and fades out, then any species which depends on eating it, well, needs to change its diet, and those who will eat different things will survive. The theory accounts for the origins of new species because what Darwin is saying, changes over time can lead to the creation of a new species. He doesn't know quite how or what point the changes will be so great that the members of this new change species would not mate and be able to breed with those of the earlier species. And it also explains why some species become extinct. Environment changes, didn't adapt. New species came along and took its place. There also was another set of evolutionary elements, which is sexual selection. That by and large, in most species, according to Darwin, there's a struggle for reproduction. That males are competing for females, and females competing for males. And given that not everyone looks or behaves the same, there are certain patterns of being or looking which the other sex will find more attractive than other patterns. Take the brightly coloured finch. and the Galapagos Islands. The male finches were quite exotically coloured. And Darwin called this sexual selection. But what happened is the females tended to like the brightly coloured males and would choose the brightest coloured males as their mates. Those who were born with drabber tail colours or drabber breast feathers, oh, they had a dickens of a job mating, and so wouldn't pass on their drabness to their offspring. But the brightly coloured ones, oh, they got the best females, the most breeding females, and the brightness was covered on from generation to generation to generation, getting brighter and brighter and brighter. It wouldn't have happened had there been predators, because brightness is not a key for survival. If there are hawks circling in the air, down there come, you see, a brightly coloured finch, and ooh, there's breakfast, ooh, there's lunch. But sexual selection of this nature could take its place in an environment without predators. Therefore, males developing brighter plumage over time, over generation after generation, because variants with bright plumage had a greater chance of reproducing. Okay. Now, what are the implications? And there's a huge implication. It's a huge implication which changed humans' views about themselves and other species. It implies that species are always in a process of change. Change doesn't stop, because those two assumptions, whenever anyone has children or offspring, there will be varieties between them, and if there are too many to survive, some will be survived and some won't, and if it's non-random, it means the species itself is in a state of change. Males' tail feathers getting longer or brighter. And the differences can over time become so great that new species emerge. As in Galapagos Islands, on neighbouring islands, two finches, one developing a big beak to get at insects out of trees, the other developing a stubby beak to break down corn. And after a while, the beaks develop in their different ways and the birds become different species, non-breeding. And therefore, according to Darwin's theory, species develop from other species. There's what he called a tree of life. Now, the origin of species did not discuss humans. Darwin feared the fuss which would happen if he discussed humans. He would go on to discuss humans. He didn't shy away for a long time, but this first book, he didn't. But it was quite clear the tree of life from fish and meat and plants right up to higher mammals and chimpanzees and gorillas, but where it was going. But it implies the tree of life that humans maybe, not that he said it, but he left it there, descended from apes who have inherited particular behaviours. And this leaves open the question, which changes for all time the way psychologists must look at the human species. Perhaps we've evolved to look in particular ways. Our hearts have evolved to pump the blood around the body, our lungs to expand and contract and so on, and those who had weaker hearts perished earlier on and so on. But is it not just our internal bodies which have evolved? Might it also be the way our brains work? That our brains have evolved oddness, like some of our emotional characteristics have evolved, some of the ways we think, some of the ways we react. And so instead of saying about emotions, oh, I don't know how it comes, why we react, why our bodies take this particular stance when we feel this emotion, this when we feel another emotion, you can say, well, has this evolved? Has this emotion evolved over time? If so, why? What is it doing? What is its biological function? And then there's the big question, because Darwin is tilting the idea away from nurture to nature, of how we're inbuilt, how we are, how we've evolved. And in essence, is Hobbes right? Or is Shaftesbury right? Have we evolved to be selfish? Is our nature? Or have we evolved to be social creatures? Is this our nature? And Darwin, by having his evolutionary theory, presents a different way of trying to answer that question of what is our nature and what should it be? Okay, more Darwin next week. I would urge you all, have a read of Darwin for yourselves. Any questions?